You are listening to Mining Stock Education, where you'll learn from the top leaders in the natural resource sector and uncover quality mining investment opportunities.
Thanks for tuning in to MSE. I'm your host, Bill Powers, chatting today with my friend Brian Lenny, who's also a co-host of the show, but also runs his own newsletter at juniorstockreview.com. Brian's a good friend, and he is an accredited investor who's been at this. Brian, has it been about 18 years you've been at this?
A long time, probably around there.
And I brought Brian on the show to talk through answers to some questions I receive over email or whether in the comment sections of YouTube, and to talk through maybe some learning issues that I see based on some of the comments that are received. And so, Brian, I want to ask you up front, when we speculate in these small junior mining stocks, can you lose money on a stock, but yet look back at your thought process and say to yourself, I made a good decision based on the information I was given, even though I lost money on this stock?
Oh, 100%. I think it really depends on what kind of company you're invested in. I think especially on the exploration side, that is probably more the truth than anything. I think you talk to a lot of geologists or even guys that have been in this business a long time that invest in exploration stocks. You can look for the big targets. You can look for the right management teams, look for that past success, and these guys can still come up empty-handed. And that's just the reality or probability of success in exploration. On the developer side, I think usually if you come up with that sort of, if you end up losing money on it, it's probably the result of timing or some other geopolitical event that's happened, whether it's permitting or some social issue in the locale of where the project's supposed to be developed. That's usually where the mistake's going to come. Or you know, if you're getting more sophisticated with it, maybe it's a little misrepresentation on the value of that company where you thought it was, you know, worth X, and the reality was because of grade or because of some other component that it didn't work for you. On the production and royalty side, I think these are the types of companies, especially for people that are looking to cut down on their losses or cut down on those moments of where you did everything right and you still lost money. That's probably where you want to stay if you want to eliminate that, because typically without the metal price really dissolving, I think most of the time you're going to be right around most of your mistakes are going to be, you know, evens, where you don't lose any money, and especially on the royalty side, right, you know, where there's even less risk to your underlying principal. So yeah, there's a spectrum, and 100% you can do everything right and still lose money in the junior resource sector, and you have to keep that in mind.
So I think the point for listeners is you might have a share price outcome for you and your personal portfolio, but at the same time, because this is speculative, it may have been a decent or qualitative decision-making process that went into it. Now, Brian, you also journal, and you take note of not only the rational, speculative argument for why you put money in a certain stock, but you also take note of your emotions, and you've told me that you use your wife to kind of critique you in that. So do you note your emotions going into an investment? And then let's say on the other side of it, you sold, you lost 40%, you look back at your journal. What is that reflective process like?
Sure. You know, I definitely do. And I'm very, try to be as self-aware as possible. And typically with the excitement that comes with a new pick or, you know, doing some work and coming up with this new idea, I'll make sure there's an adequate amount of time. I don't rush into it. At least sleep 24 hours or have one day of sleep on that to think about it and let it rest. I don't know, impulse buying, you know, whether it's, you know, consumer goods or stocks, I think there can be a tendency for people to get overexcited, over-optimistic, and you get into that chase mode where you're trying to chase a company. And so often you see in the junior resource sector that this is the wrong mentality. Most of these stocks are highly volatile and they usually come back to you. And the other thing I've noticed is that on reflection, you know, I read back that article that I was going to potentially send out and see some mistakes. You know, I more so when I early on in my career, I kept this piece of paper beside my desk, and what it was a bunch of rules that I'd set out, and it was a constant checklist for me to go through. Like, am I missing anything? Like, is it the right management team? Am I doing this based on the value proposition and not a metal price, you know, supposition? These are the things I was trying to check. And today it's to make sure my emotions in check. to make sure that I'm clear exactly why I'm buying it, why I'm buying it now, and what those risks are, and sort of that dichotomy between the two of them. And then with my wife has always been a great sounding board for me, with where I am, you know, with everything else that's going on in my life. Because I think for everybody, you have outside sources that are impacting the way you make decisions, whether it's making you more impulsive, or maybe not lazy, but maybe less involved or less energy towards the research that you're doing. And you have to be honest with yourself. And if you have that person that you can, you know, sound things off of, or can look at you and say, hey, you know, you're more hyped up than you should, than you usually are. Also, my wife reads all my articles. She's my proofreader. So she can sort of see in how I'm writing something. And if I can't explain it to her, who knows nothing about resource sector investing, then I'm not doing a very good job. And so again, that's another way that I use my ideas and try to express why I want to invest or divest in a company. Because those dive, like I just made a sale in the newsletter just over two or around 2 weeks ago. And I wanted to be really sure that I was making the right move, that it wasn't based on some emotion, which is, it was kind of an emotional journey with that company over the last year and a bit. And so I wanted to make sure, very sure that I was making the right decision and lay those points out for myself. And she was able to read it and she said, yeah, you know what? You laid it out very concisely and I understand why you're selling it. So those are things that I use. And, you know, I've said before in presentations that I've done that writing stuff out is probably paramount to my success as an investor because it crystallizes all the reasons why or why I don't like a company. So I highly suggest that people do that and incorporate that into their own practice.
So obviously your money's at risk in this company, so there is that emotional attachment. But what made this one perhaps more of an emotional roller coaster than other investments you've had in the resource sector?
Well, it's actually a good point. I think, and I've sort of made this mistake slightly before in overextending myself into one position and having one company maybe be able to make or break me. This wasn't to the extent that I've done it in the past. But it probably was a little bit more of an allocation than I should have taken, especially considering that it was sort of a new part of the resource sector that I was entering. So there was some emotion attached to that because it meant so much more to my underlying portfolio. And that sort of goes what I think with a lot of people need to learn, hopefully not on the unfortunate side of things, but you don't want, especially at the beginning, you don't want to take a position that can blow you out. Meaning that if you're not right, that this position is going to eliminate you from that learning process, from that opportunity to hit a bull market, when you invariably actually can make money and you can make money even on your mistakes, which is again something that can be problematic for people who start in bull markets, because it's a disguise for what success really is, and you take heed of those moments, but you don't want to blow yourself out. You're going to have to learn. You're going to have to lose money. Goes back to your first question. Without a doubt, you're going to do all the right things and still lose money in this sector, but you have to expect that. You just don't want that mistake to eliminate you from the game, or you know, make you late for a mortgage payment or interrupt your life in some aspect. You know, Rick Rule says, you know, when he speculates in expiration stocks, he said many times, you know, the make or break in this company isn't going to change what I have for breakfast or have for dinner. And you need to take the same mentality. Like you can get greedy and you can say, oh, I'm going to put it all in on this one company because I know. Unfortunately, nobody knows. And you can still lose money on those things that you're even of high conviction and you're probably right for the most part.
But Rick also says that he invests now with the money that he made, the boatload of money he made speculating, right?
That's right. Invariably, you can say somewhat the same for me. You know, like I know more now how much risk I actually did take. Mind you, I think I was a little bit smart about how I did it. Like I only used about 2/3 of that money that I took from selling my house. And I knew I needed that other third to manage my life. But I took a boatload of risk. The other side to it is that it comes down to that price truly is the best de-risker that you can have. So even though I was putting my money at risk in these highly volatile, mostly, you know, bad companies, on a whole. I was buying them at really good prices, and I had the courage to hold them and wait, and sort of ignorantly, until that bull market came, and I was successful from it. And honestly, Bill, like I'm sort of glad that in retrospect, I think it helped me that I didn't have a house, because I had to pull that money out of the market. I had to go buy some things to stabilize my life. And if I didn't have that, it probably would have been straight up and then straight down, because I wouldn't have known what I know now in terms of, like, you have to be able to buy at the right price, but maybe even more importantly, you have to be able to sell and de-risk your positions. And, you know, these things I've learned over time, but I've never been in a better position than I am today to navigate this market. And I'm really looking forward to this next bull run in precious metals, if that's indeed where we are.
So you needed to sell in order to access some money to buy a house. So, like, so an external factor, you know, pushed down upon your thinking process, if I could say this here, to make you sell. But if you didn't have that, are you saying you would have probably held on and perhaps held on too long?
Yeah. Yeah. And I probably would have been disillusioned, because I've talked about this before. I would have ridden that roller coaster up, and I'm like, oh, I'm so smart. I did this, I did that. And if you look at my experience, was that I bought low and I held. And I probably would have prolonged that same sort of thinking. And the fact is, there's so very few companies in this sector that are actually long-term holds. And long-term means something different to everybody. But I know more and more that most of these things are trades. And sometimes you do need a couple of years for the investment thesis to play out. But you have to be concerned about things, about dilution, about geopolitics, about cycle. And so all of these have to work into your investment thesis, and it's not just one component. This is why I think being an investor is so much more than, you know, just being good at one aspect, whether, you know, you're a geologist and you're really good at geology. But if you're not good at valuing something or selling or managing your emotion or understanding how capital markets work, you know, there's holes, and really good investors are able to put all of those things together and make good decisions. And the more good decisions you make, obviously, the more successful you're going to be. But, you know, more than ever, you do have to go through that process of making mistakes and work your way towards that point where you can be more consistent.
Brian, when it comes to selling, I had a good friend who's known me for about 17 years, even when I was working in the nonprofit sector. And when I had a big gain in a stock, he was like, Bill, I want you to think about how many years of your life that even when you're in business and doing better than average, it took you to earn that amount. And then he said, think back to when you're in the nonprofit sector. That's like four decades of your life with what you were earning at that point. He's like, take some money off the table. And it's good to kind of have a voice of reason in a high risk sector speaking into your life. And that's the importance of a network, right? And people who understand you and who understand the risk your money is at in this sector.
Oh, 100%. I see it with both sides, because I've experienced it. So I was very, very lucky that some of the people I looked up to the most, I actually became friends with, and they were in my ear about selling. And I heard them, and I was like, oh, you know what? I could see how successful they've been. You could kind of parlay. It's like, yeah, that's where I want to be. Yet when it comes to practice, you sit there in front of your computer or on your phone, and you're in the moment and you don't remember, you know, I need to sell part of this, or I need to buy this at this time. And that's why I say, like, there's probably going to be points that you're going to resonate with, and you're going to act, you're going to hear it. You're like, that makes total sense, and I'm going to do it. And then there's going to be some things that you hear and you're going to say, that makes sense, and you are not going to do. And that's kind of the process that I've gone through. And again, selling was one of those points. And I do give full credit to my mentors. Actually, if you go back to the interview I did with Rick, I guess about a month ago. And
on this show for listeners.
On this show, yeah. Yeah. And Rick, he's absolutely true. He says your successes are usually based or founded in others, and your mistakes are all yours. And he's absolutely right. And again, just as long as you don't blow yourself out with those mistakes you're going to make, then that's the way you want to be. And finding mentors, finding people whose whose mentality or outlook in the market that you respect and you can draw from, I think are integral to all of our successes. And so you definitely want to incorporate, you know, the wisdom of others into your process.
So when it comes to selling, I see this in the comment sections a lot. Somebody will say, oh, I wish I'd never found mining stocks, but because I'm down 70%, now I have to hold. This is like verbatim or close to it, what I see often. But what you're saying is, even with what you just decided, even though it was disappointing, not the outcome you wanted, you are willing to sell because, as Rick says, he's like 25% of your capital is better than getting 0% of your capital returned to you, right?
That's right. Well, and I think you know, the biggest thing people should look at when they see a comment like that, why did you buy the company in the first place?
They don't know, Brian.
I know they don't. The second point is, so when were you going to sell it?
And this they don't know that either.
I know. And this is that fundamental thing where you first start off with the value proposition. You need to understand what you think that company is worth. Now, there can be mistakes in there, and I'm sure there will be mistakes, but that's where you need to start. And then you compare that value to what the company is actually selling for, and there's going to be a differential there. You have to decide whether if that differential is worth you speculating on. And depending on where you are in the cycle, should give you somewhat of an answer. If we're in the midst of a bull market, there's a ton of momentum, you see people happy around you, then, you know, these risks aren't quite as profound. But when you're in the midst of a bear market and people aren't giving value to anything, then you have to take that into consideration too, and make sure that you're buying for the right reasons and that those catalysts that the company may have will actually grab market attention. And just look back at yourself. When you read headlines, what do you get attracted to? You know, metallurgical recoveries go up to 95% from 90%, or 100 grams per ton over 10 meters. Probably the drill result. Although I would argue that the 5% improvement in metal recovery could be just as impactful to the economics of the company. But that has to do with your knowledge base. But I would say most of the sector probably is more attracted to drill results than they are metallurgical recovery. So those are the sorts of things that I think you need to take heed to. And then just putting thought into it. You start off with that value proposition, you get into the company, but then you should also have a sell price. Whether that's, if the NPV is $100 million and they're going to have a feasibility study released in the next 6 months, then maybe the target value is 50% of that net present value. And that's when you sell. Or if a geopolitical event happens and you don't have the courage to wait it out, or you don't have the time, you don't want to waste your money's time in the market, then you need to sell before it hits 75% down, and sell on that news that, you know, this is probably going to take longer than you thought, or they're not going to get their permit, rather than let it go down to 75% and then come up with the question, I have to stay now because I'm, you know, as they say in poker, I'm pot committed. You want to avoid those sorts of situations, make decisions proactively rather than reactively to a certain extent, as much as you can. And I think you'll be, you know, way ahead of the game.
So in order to make decisions proactively rather than reactively, what is your emotional relationship like with the company that you put a lot of money at risk in and disappointed you? You know, do you just break it off and don't think about it again? Or is it like a bad relationship where you're arguing with your past girlfriend in your head and telling her everything you think is wrong about her? Because I see that in the comments too. What is a healthy way to move forward so you can learn and then make better decisions?
You're saying that you full out sell the company? Is that
when you sell and it's a disappointment, you had your thesis going into it, management disappointed, or they didn't execute, what have you, you decide it's time to sell, you take your losses, and then what is your relationship with that company? Because some people, when they lose money, they're still preoccupied with the person that told them about that company, how they first learned about it, or management, and there's like an emotional string around them, and it affects their thinking process, is kind of what I'm getting at.
Right. So for me, it's like pulling off a Band-Aid. It's sort of quick and off I go on to the next thing. In terms of like my connection, watching news flow, that sort of thing, I'm able to cut it pretty quick. The side note to that is I do think that you need to, as an investor, look at what went wrong. And highlight those points, like understand what you may have been too optimistic about. Technically, what did you miss? You know, were you too late in selling it? Was there a point back that you should have seen, you know, three or four months ago that should have told you, hey, look, nothing's going to change with these guys. We need to cut bait now while we're down 10% or 15%. I think the mentality for a lot of the sales, or even your question previously, is that things are going to turn around and I'm going to make my money back. Rick says, you know, every day that you don't sell a stock, you buy it. And if you take that mentality, I think more often than not, you're going to make better decisions. And you go back to this conversation we're having now, when you start dissecting where you went wrong, I'm sure you'll look back and you'll find some instances where it should have kind of triggered something in your head and said, hey, look, this probably isn't going to change and I need to move on. And so basically what you're trying to do is just trying to figure out where you went wrong and so that you don't do it again, whether it's with a similar company or a similar situation with a management team or a share structure or geopolitics. You know, some people will make they'll invest in the right company. It's like the project is great, but it's in a tough jurisdiction and they unfortunately get hit by a 30% loss because, you know, war erupts or some social unrest and they lose money. Well, if you're not comfortable with it, you know, you probably shouldn't go back and you should probably stick to the so-called tier one jurisdictions that maybe on the social, they all have their own risk, but maybe it's not quite as volatile as, you know, some parts of Africa or some parts of South America or Asia to a certain extent. So these are the sorts of things I think you want to pull out of those losses. But in terms of like how you deal with it, to me, it's you cut bait as quickly as you can, stop following their news flow, take them off your watch list and move on to the next company or the next idea that you have and pursue it and try not to make those same mistakes.
What would you say to those that, let's say, over idealize or romanticize a bull move in a given commodity, the supply demand dynamics, and so then they just load up on juniors in just this one commodity and the commodity does move up and then it moves back down as these things go up and down, they're very volatile, and then after it moves down 40% after, let's say, a 250% move, they didn't sell anything, and then it's all about why it's going to go up more and more. And I see this mentality, and because the industry is so cyclical, I'm saying to myself, you know, diversification out of not just that commodity could be a good thing. But based on your experience, Brian, what might you say to somebody? Because I see these comments on Twitter too, and I'm like, I hope you're right, but you may not be right. Because even the bull moves that you've experienced in the last year, and then the 40% drop, that could have been the move. And I from my own experience in 2016, when silver went up from $14 to whatever, $30, I got it right. And I was up 10 times on some juniors. And my wife is just saying, well, why don't you just sell them? Like, she would say to me, when is enough enough? And then, of course, I hold it until it comes back down to the low 20s, right? So your thoughts, Brian.
So I'll preface this with, I have made these mistakes before. And again, this is something that a particular mentor helps me, you know, work through, but I did have to make my own mistakes. And the thing is, nobody can predict metal prices with any consistency. Most commentary you'll see in the business is all centered around where commodities or prices are headed. Yet, you know, people can never truly get it right. And if you look at any type of commodity trader who trades based on the price of metals, they're always hedged on their price prediction because they know that, you know, nobody can be that consistent, especially on the micro. On the macro, you can say in the next 10 years, yes, you know, oil might spike or silver might spike, but a lot of things flow into that. But on the micro, day to day, month to month, week to week, you can see these commodities traders always hedge their bets, and that's because they don't know. Second to that, if you look at it, you know, parlaying commodity price to a junior company has, let's say, 10 or 12 things where you could lose money. Metal price is just one of those 10 or 12 things. So even if you're right on the metal price, you can still be wrong on the company. So that's another point that people need to take heed of. Like, just because you think, let's say, the silver price is going to go up, well, if it's a bad management team or it's a bad jurisdiction, you can still lose money on that speculation. So when it comes to parlaying metal price to company investment, I think it's a lesson, unfortunately, a lot of people have to learn, because there's so many ways a junior can lose you money outside of just being right or wrong on the metal price. Second to that, bull markets end. You know, a presentation I did back would have been January at the Metals Investors Forum. I talked about just this point. And this is not a commentary on uranium or anything, but you can sort of see the same sort of patterns that you talked about in whether it was lithium, nickel, gold from 2020. Maybe it's uranium to a certain extent now, where you know you can look at the price chart where it spikes into this euphoric state. There's still a ton of reasons why you think that lithium should still be at $60,000 a ton or uranium should be $150 a ton. The fact is...
Per pound, sorry.
But there's tons of reasons why for you to still be bullish. But just as you're saying, Bill, these bull markets all come to an end per se. And they're going to move up and down. And, you know, as investors, that's why if you're going to use junior companies as a vehicle to leverage or play the commodity price, you just have to be aware of where you're investing. And so you didn't really care if you bought when uranium was $25 and you buy, let's say, NexGen, which is arguably one of the best undeveloped projects held by a junior. You bought it when uranium was that price. You rode it all the way up to the top. To me, you know, those profits were there for you to take, and you don't really care if uranium is, well, I shouldn't say you shouldn't really care if uranium's got, you know, this much more to run or doesn't, because you should be profit taking along and then let it dip and then buy it on the dip. And so it doesn't mean you have to get completely out of the company or lose your bullishness, but just realize these things work in cyclical ways. And then you sell a bit at the top, it comes back down, you're still bullish. You buy a little bit more when it goes, you know, goes up to 10 bucks, comes back down to seven, you buy at seven. If it still fits your original thesis, you know, you still had to have said, okay, the value is this and it's worth this. But that's sort of my take on how you, the difference between playing a metal price and then playing the junior resource sector. And the other side is if you were really bullish on a metal price, then buy the metal. So you can, you know, Sprott has a number of physical trusts, the gold, silver, platinum, palladium. You've got the uranium trust. These are all plays basically on the commodity price, and their essential risk is just that. So if you're really bullish, those are the things that you should be looking for, is the stuff that is the pure play. But I'm telling you, it's a tough game to play.
When you get online communities that are become like these intense echo chambers for a bullish perspective on a commodity, do you find any utility in them, or how do you view that, Brian, as an investor?
Personally, I don't. I think that, you know, I don't pay that much attention to commentary on where metal prices are headed. I definitely like to know about, you know, where things are headed or where they may not be headed. I'll listen to those high level points, but usually it just triggers me to do my own research and kind of to try to understand supply and demand, maybe come up with where I think something might be headed. But I certainly don't hang my hat anymore on where I think metal prices are headed. I'm looking for companies that have realistic catalysts to capture market attention and to close that value differential. And I think that's where money is made. And I think, you know, if you understand where you are in the cycle, especially with where that company is, not the company cycle and the metal cycle, where those two coincide, if you can pick those right, I think that's where you make your money, sort of regardless whether it's a bear or a bull. But obviously, you know, a bull makes it that much easier.
Brian, since there's no perfect investments in the junior mining sector, if the lead management executives are not what the best for this company or the best to move it forward, for you, is it always an avoid? And a little context is, I've invested in a company where after significant due diligence, it wasn't just a rash decision, but there was a lot of effort and even travel that went into it. After that first due diligence process, I talked to a key investor and a board member and told them both, I think that management needed to be replaced. Not gotten rid of, but just brought on as an advisor on a contract basis, just based on their historic knowledge of the company and what the company is trying to accomplish. So that was voiced. There was some agreement, but also the communication that nothing's going to be done. Well, it didn't work out for me. And I think that under different leadership, it could have done better. Even though there was a lot of things going and reasons for me to invest, when you have that objection or that concern for you, do you always avoid?
I wouldn't say always avoid, but I would say, you know, where I am with my knowledge of the sector, typically I would say there's more chance that I avoid these days, or definitely look at it as a short-term trade. If I see a catalyst that's associated with it, you know, so often I've seen the pitfalls of bad management teams, and I get the premise that, you know, good projects, you can't recreate geology around the world and blah, blah, blah. But they can do so much damage in terms of dilution, in terms of their perception, like the brand that gets associated with the company. Like bad management teams, you know, they get associated with that company name, and it takes a while for it to be unwound. And especially if they get caught in whatever kind of like nefarious things that they're involved in.
Sometimes it's just laziness and lack of effort too, right?
Yeah, there's that too. Well, you know what? I honestly, if that's the case, then I'd probably be more prone to maybe taking a stab at it. But again, still, I've seen too many, experienced too many times where that sort of management team loses me money, especially if the cycle isn't with me. Again, there's so many points. Like, the answer should always probably be it depends. But I can say typically I'll, especially these days, I would avoid it if I really don't have confidence in what management can do or sort of the direction that they have. And I've, like, there's a couple examples. I won't get into the names, but I can see that I wasn't the only one thinking that. But, and I've seen the management teams get turned over, and it took more than a year, and it took a couple of the bigger investors to sort of come to that conclusion themselves, obviously. But you can see it. And yeah, so for me, it's generally, I will avoid it. And that's more and more, but it depends.
Brian, I want to ask you about how you view the forward-looking statements, the projections, the anticipatory statements that management makes, and what do you do when it doesn't happen? So for example, even on this channel, I'll disclose that, you know, there's executives via sponsored interviews that are making forward-looking statements, and that is their job, because these are speculative venture capital endeavors. These are big scientific projects, a lot of them at the exploration stage. So you got to tell investors what we're doing to try to hopefully create value, find mineralization, develop production. But I've even been asked, could you take down a video because what I said didn't come to pass? And my answer was no. It's like, you can't do that. You said it's out there. Plus the Wayback Machine has it anyway. it is what it is, you know, and it is what it is. And that's not fair to investors, because especially if they put money in based on your forward-looking statement, and then we don't want to act like you didn't make that statement, because that's what lured in the dollars. So what's your take? How much leeway do you give management? It's kind of like, you know, burn me once, you know, your fault, burn me twice, my fault, you know, what's your take?
Hey, again, well, it does depend what it is. So forward looking to me, like if a guy says that something's going to happen within Q1 or Q2, and depending on what that item is, I'm not even sure what the better parallel, like if you're waiting on assays, and enough time has happened where, you know, there's been bull moves and there's been significant delays for assays in different parts of the world. So if a guy says you're going to have results back in Q1, it ends up being Q2, you know, that's to me is not a big deal. And that's not really reflective of what the company did or didn't do. It's probably reflective of the market. Now, I think that got overdone. I think a few companies probably took advantage of that excuse and let things kind of maybe go by the wayside. I'm just guessing. But it really does depend on what it is. And so if management teams are saying they're going to do this or that, depending on what it is, has a bigger impact on me. In terms of the promotion, I do expect them to talk about how big or how great and all those things about what a prospect could be, especially on the exploration side. Promotion is such a big key of moving share prices up. If people don't understand and aren't excited about your company, then you know, you probably have somewhat of an issue, unless your results do happen to catch market attention. But that's not always the case, or it's not always the case right away. You know, it's a lot of these things are iterative, and these guys are vectoring in on, you know, potential targets, and it takes time. But I've never understood some of the mentalities of, and we've talked about this on a, you know, off screen, about some reluctance of management teams to do promotion or good promotion. My results will speak for themselves. And like, well, No, not always. And I think you do need to be able to talk about how great something is, draw those parallels, and garner some attention from the market. I think it only helps you. On the flip side, you also don't want to be too egregious with what you say. And again, it really does depend on what the person says in terms of how I deal with it. But typically, if a management's saying I'm going to do something by a certain date, you want to hold them to that, and they should hold themselves to that. But there are situations that are out of their control, and you have to be able to understand or at least accept that to a certain extent too.
And so that's the key to what you said. I try to determine what they can control and what they can't control. But if they've made, like, you're growing production and you've made, you know, four statements in a row that you're like off target by a lot, it's kind of like, you know, not only is the train not leaving the station, the train's going backwards, right? So, you know, I guess, it, like you said, there's a lot of variables. Is it a pre-production story? Is it a growth story? Is it a development story? Is it an explorer? So there's so many variables. And I guess what I'm pointing out now for newer listeners in particular is that to make a decision, there's not a one-size-fits-all. You have to take even what we're saying and you have to fuse it with your own experience, which just takes time. And there's no substitute for time in this sector, is there, Brian?
No, I think life in general, you could put it that way. You know, we're all on our own journey towards hopefully being the best that you can be as a person. And you parallel that to the investor world, where more and more I see you're going to have to make these mistakes yourself and sort of learn, listen and learn, and just don't blow yourself out before you can learn those lessons and sort of form your process for making money. Because that's the other thing, is there is no one process that's going to fit everybody. You're going to have your own nuance to it. And just as long as it's true to what you know and what you don't know, and how you're able to play the market, you know, you have to find that out for yourself.
Excellent. We'll end it there. To learn more about Brian and what he offers, go to juniorstockreview.com. He offers you a glimpse into how he is investing in his portfolio, as well as gives a weekly commentary. Brian, you're a good friend. You've taught me a lot through our friendship about investing in junior resource stocks. So thanks for coming on the show today, and thank you for co-hosting part-time also.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
Thank you for listening to Mining Stock Education. Please subscribe and share this show with like-minded investors. Connect with us at miningstockeducation.com and sign up for our email list to stay in touch. Much success to you as you learn about, invest in, and profit from mining stocks.
The mining business is one that generates gigantic wealth. You know, a good drill hole that converts might cost $50,000 or $100,000, and it might discover something worth a couple billion.
There is no sector that I know of that has offered up as many predictable circumstances where there was the possibility, certainly not the certainty, but the possibility of 10-for-1 returns as there is in small cap and micro cap mining stocks. Concomitant with that, if you don't do the work, or even if you do the work and don't discipline yourself on the sell side, there are very few places in the world where you can lose as much money as quickly as in mining stocks too.
I just started to study up on mining stocks, and I just became fascinated because this is such a tiny sector and it's so volatile that either you could do really, really well, or you could pretty much get blown out of the water really quickly.
The mining sector is a very risky sector. It can take your money very, very quickly. Don't fall in love with stocks. Don't be overly confident. And just do your work as best you can. Do your very best. But don't fall in love and don't get too overly confident, because that's a recipe for disaster.
I have met, you know, professional retail investors that have made a tremendous amount of money on the junior mining space. Some of them aren't accredited, and they spend their days researching, talking to people, being on the phone, pouring through financial documents. But it requires commitment.
This podcast is for informational purposes only and is not to be considered personal legal or investment advice or a recommendation to buy or sell securities or any other product. We make every effort to be accurate, but the information presented is not to be considered infallible. It may contain errors, and we offer no inferred or explicit warranty. If personal advice is needed, consult a qualified legal, tax, or investment professional. Do not base any investment decision on the information contained on miningstockeducation.com, our podcasts, or videos. Make sure you always conduct your own
own thorough due diligence before investing, realize that we may hold equity positions in or be compensated by some of the companies we feature and therefore are biased and hold an obvious conflict of interest. For our full disclaimer, please visit our website.